What I'm going to talk, I was thinking how I should, you know, frame this, what I'll be speaking about today, a little bit more generally. For one, it's coming out of a study that I'm working on presently, where I'm trying to write a cultural history of Germany and the Middle East from the Middle Ages to the present. And what I'll be speaking about today is mainly from that first chapter, and then bridges, some of it though, into the modern period. But also, one of my concerns has been that even though the last 25 years we've seen in the humanities a lot of discussions of ideological forces that shaped, determined, brought about, and reflected power relations between Europe and the rest of the world, I believe that we haven't talked enough about the role Christianity played in all this. So we talked a lot about culture, different kind of ideological aspects related to culture and identity, somewhat talked about the economic side of things. We haven't really talked a lot about Christianity's role. And so my paper today is sort of a contribution to that discussion, which I think should be going on, particularly at the moment with everything that's going on in the Middle East. So looking at the German case and want to discuss how German rulers established a claim to sovereignty over the Holy Land during the Middle Ages. So for the most part, I'll be talking about the Middle Ages, but then also how these claims are relevant to understanding Germany's relationship to the Holy Land, and more generally also to the Middle East and into the modern era. So at the end, I'll bring this back into the modern era. And I will begin by sketching the larger historical context that is relevant to understanding the medieval period. Then I turn to the textual archive that reflects and shapes this relationship, and I will focus on one particular genre, namely the world chronicles, and take a look at the sources that were employed by the authors of various medieval world chronicles, and discuss the different histories that were involved, the biblical, Roman, Greek histories that were invoked in these texts, and then discuss how the emphasis on these different sources and histories established distinct German ties to the Holy Land, and ties that are relevant to understanding relevant to understanding the renewed German interest in the Middle East in the 19th century. And I believe are also important to understanding what's going on today. So it's the German case, but on a larger scale, it's also about Europe, the West, and the Middle East. And in a way, what I'm doing here is I'm turning Edward Said the notion of Orientalism on its head, because if Said has claimed that the Orient was always Europe's other, I'm saying that if there's one area that was always claimed as part of Europe's self, it was Palestine, which is particularly interesting in light of Edward Said's point of departure. So maybe in the discussion we can talk a little bit about that also. I want to begin with a little anecdote or story here. In 1064, Bishop Gunther of Bamberg led a group of more than 7,000 pilgrims, by some accounts even 12,000 pilgrims, on a pilgrimage to the Holy Land. Significantly fewer would return the following year. The chronicle Vita Altmanni from about 1130 reported the stress of the long journey and the substantial loss of life due to disease, but also skirmishes with Muslims. According to available records, this group of pilgrims was the largest single group of German pilgrims traveling to the place that was central to every Christian living in Germany at the time, namely Jerusalem. But it was by no means the only group of pilgrims. During that period, a steady flow of German and other European pilgrims moved back and forth between Europe and the Holy Land. Beginning in the 3rd century, the pilgrimage to Jerusalem became central in the lives of medieval Europeans. The Christianization of the Roman Empire under Constantine the Great had turned Palestine into a Christian area and fostered the establishment of pilgrimage rituals. Over time, the pilgrimage to Jerusalem was sustained by an elaborate infrastructure that facilitated this early form of mass tourism. Special guides provided the pilgrims with relevant information. Routes, inns, restaurants, and visa conditions were discussed in detail. German pilgrims relied on a network of hospices, inns, and restaurants all the way to the Holy Land. So you could pretty much have German beer and German bread all the way from Germany to the Holy Land during the medieval period. So for medieval Germans, the Holy Land was a place more significant and more real than it is for today's Germans, in spite of the easier access made possible through modern travel and media coverage. At the time, the spiritual center of the world was Jerusalem, and biblical history was understood as world history. Medieval maps illustrated the Christian geographical interpretation of the world. The so-called T-map and other world maps, such as the Ebsdorfer Weltkarte from the middle of the 13th century, placed Jerusalem at the center of the world. The physical reality of the Holy Land was proof of the veracity of the Christian faith, and pilgrimages to the Holy Land allowed believers to experience for themselves the actuality of biblical places. In all religions, pilgrimages are viewed as a way to achieve holiness in one's lifetime. Medieval Christians went on local, regional, and long-distance pilgrimages, but the journey, you know, all kinds of different pilgrimages, but the journey to the Holy Land was a dream of every pious Christian. And I want to emphasize here that this is all sort of real. I mean, the Holy Land was a place that was experienced and understood as an actual place. This is by no means sort of an imaginary relationship to that territory. Whereas the steady flow of pilgrims to the Holy Land tied Germany to the Middle East in an intimate way, the connection to the area was also expressed in political terms when Germans founded a new empire in 962 with Otto I as the first emperor. This political structure signaled a twofold claim to sovereignty over the Holy Land. By 983, German emperors were addressed as Roman emperors, which was already a title of Charlemagne, and in 1034, the phrase Romanum Imperium became officially part of the empire's title. By invoking the Roman Empire, Germans asserted the Holy Land as an integral part of the new empire's political structure. The title Sacrum Imperium was added in 1157 and emphasized the religious dimension of this twofold claim to sovereignty. Palestine, to use the Roman coined term for the larger area, had been controlled by Greek and Roman rulers for many centuries. In 301 BCE, the area was occupied by the Ptolemies, and a century later, Hellenistic rule was continued under the Seleucids. After close to a century of Jewish autonomy under the Hasmonean dynasty, the Romans captured Jerusalem in 63 BCE. While the Hellenistic era was one of multicultural coexistence, Roman rule and increasing Christian influence destroyed the Jewish sovereignty over the area. After the partition of the Roman Empire in 395, East Roman rule continued until the Persian invasion of 614, followed by the Muslim conquest of Palestine beginning in 634. So with all these, you know, various figures here, when Arab Muslim armies occupied the area, a period of more than 800 years under the rule of Europe-based empires came to an end. German emperors of the Holy Roman Empire who aspired to carry on the legacy of the Romans also laid claim to Palestine. This twofold claim to legitimate rule over the Holy Land through Roman and Christian legacies, so political and religious claims, was actualized by way of the pilgrimages. An actual contingent of Germans was always present in the Holy Land, and through the pilgrimages, news traveled back to Germany, relating details about the journey, the stay in Palestine, and the actual living conditions in the area. Germany's relationship to the Holy Land was therefore, as I mentioned earlier, by no means imaginary. Through the pilgrimages and the belief in the actuality of the Christian message, the lands of the Bible occupied a special presence in the minds of German and other European Christians. Germans were also connected to the Middle East by way of another point of contact, namely through the Muslim presence in Spain. Invading Spain in 711, Muslims had extended their rule to southern France. The onslaught came to a halt when Karl Martel fought the invading armies at Pointe-Poitiers in 732. The following centuries led to the gradual recovery of Spanish territory by Christian armies. We know this as a Reconquista, and ended with the expulsion of Muslims and Jews in 1492. News about the confrontations between Muslims and Christians traveled north, and Germans followed the events closely. For example, there's a poem by Huswin von Gandersheim which documents the fact that Germans were very much aware of the events in Muslim Spain, and a number of writings were based on eyewitness reports rather than any kind of written documentation that then traveled slowly north. In addition, pilgrims returning from journeys to Santiago de Compostela, which next to Jerusalem and Rome was one of the most popular medieval destinations for pilgrims, also ensured the exchange of information from northern to southern Europe. It's important to consider the extent of this exchange of information and the realities of pilgrims' travel in order to show that the Crusades represented not a radical break with a prior state of affairs, but rather an intensification of it that had been developing for decades. As mentioned before, the number of pilgrims had been increasing steadily over the course of the 10th and 11th centuries, which has led scholars to express the shift from pilgrimage to crusade with the phrase armed pilgrimages. That is, the crusades fit along a continuum of previously existing pilgrimage conventions and a twofold claim to sovereignty over the Holy Land. So in summary, the Crusades really were part of a larger set of expanding movements. In the West, the Spanish continued to regain territory from Muslim conquerors. Germans set out to Christianize and colonize areas in Eastern Europe. The Mediterranean Sea was, you know, always a stage for a continuous strife between Europeans and Arabs. And the Crusades then brought these expansive ambitions farther south. So how did medieval Germans articulate their ideas about events related to and then later occurring in the Holy Land? German texts declaring the Christian claim to sovereignty over the Holy Land were written even prior to the call for a crusade in 1095. Some texts go back to the end of the 9th century. And I'm leaving out here texts that were critical of the Crusades, and also texts that picked up themes from the encounter with the Orient but didn't really talk about the Crusades per se. Didn't really take a stance on this whole issue, but, you know, still picked up a lot of the topics. So I'm leaving out all that material, which is quite a bit, actually. So mostly what I'm looking at here is religious propaganda literature, if you wish, which was often composed in Latin and supported the call to arms and presented the benefits of participation in these religious wars to believers. And it's actually really important to think a bit about the role Latin played here, because it's really key to understanding this connection between medieval Europe and, again, Rome, and the claim that was made to various territories through affiliating oneself with the Roman Empire. So Latin really plays a key role here in creating this continuity, and both, again, both the religious and the political claims, so both expressed through Latin. Sermons, admonitions, and hymns called upon believers to take up arms to defend the holy sites of Christianity. The crusades were also promoted in epics and poems. Two textual traditions were influential for medieval world chronicles, and that's the one genre I want to talk about in a bit more detail. And both these traditions articulated this claim to the Holy Land. One is the biblical tradition, and it's, in a way, it's obvious, but let me just review a few aspects here. So the Bible was read as a historical text. Believers understood themselves to be along a timeline that began with the creation of the world and would end with the apocalypse, as laid out, for example, in the last chapter of the New Testament, the revelation of St. John the Divine. Relevant to the medieval world medieval Christian view of history were the teachings of Augustine, I never know how to pronounce this, Augustine, you know, late 4th century, early 5th century. His theory of the aetatis mundi, the ages of the world, divides history into different ages, from Adam to the flood, from Noah to Abraham, from Abraham to David to the Babylonian exile, and from the Babylonian exile to the birth of Jesus Christ. According to this model, the duration of the sixth age, which began with the birth of Christ, is not known. This age would be followed by the seventh age, the Sabbath, which then would be succeeded by the age of God. Speculation about the actual date of the end of the world was very popular during the Middle Ages. Interpretations of the book of Daniel, for example, led Christians to believe in the impending end of the world. The second chapter of that book describes four kingdoms, which are followed by the heavenly kingdom. Medieval and also later commentary on this passage equated the kingdoms with the reigns of Babylonians, Persians, Greeks, and Romans, and concluded that the end of the world was near. So, I mean, I want to emphasize here that biblical history was always translated into actual world history. Even if interpretations of biblical history did not result in apocalyptic visions, medieval Germans viewed time as sacred and history as the actualization of the divine message. The second group of texts that are important here are those that refer back to antiquity, and through stories drawing on especially Greek and Roman material, medieval Germans fantasized also about ruling Oriental and, in particular, Middle Eastern territories. The German claim to biblical lands was in particular formulated in texts that focused on the life of Alexander the Great, whose empire brought together European, North African, Middle Eastern, and Asian territories. The figure of Alexander inspired reworkings of the material in diverse cultures and historical periods and in a range of literary genres. And indeed, texts about Alexander played a central role in Greek, Roman, Islamic, Christian, Syrian, Ethiopian, medieval, French, Latin, German, and all kinds of other literatures. In each case, the material was adapted to the specific context and often reworked ideologically in very different ways. But important here is that the episodes about Alexander's life articulate the encounter between Europe and the Orient and the omnipresence of the material documents the culture ties between Europe and the Middle East, including North Africa. The Alexander material was only one of several themes of antiquity that that were picked up by German authors. Whereas the Aeneas received less attention, the Trojan War and the story of King Apollonius of Tyre were popular themes. This material illustrates how themes dating back to the classical period were received in medieval Europe and demonstrate that Germans were able to see themselves as successors to Greek and Roman heritage long before the Renaissance. These epics and legends thus play a key role in the transmission of cultural heritage from antiquity to medieval Europe, but also in creating this timeline and political continuity also. So world chronicles drew on both traditions, the biblical and the classical, and functioned to strengthen the Christian and German claim to territories in the Middle East. And as we know, both these traditions were relevant well into the 20th century. In particular, the Habsburg dynasty drew heavily on both these traditions, but then also, in a way, beginning in the 18th century, secular nation states managed to secularize these knowledges and also place themselves in this tradition, in particular the Greek and Roman tradition. So I should point out that chronicles are different from biographical vitae and from the annals, which is the official record of monasteries, of a monastery or other institution. And there are also different types of of chronicles. But the genre that I focus on here is specifically that of the world chronicles. World chronicles can be seen as attempts to conceptualize world history from a point of view that integrates the eschatological view of the world, namely history as biblical history, and aspects of world history that were not addressed in the Bible. These texts thus narrate world history from the point of view of Christian eschatology, but place different emphasis on sacred and secular history. And some of the differences in approach are quite notable. And I'll present a few examples here. One is Otto von Freising's Universal History, Historia de Duabus Civitatibus, from 1132 to 46, which is a chronicle written in Latin, and chronicles world history from the beginning of creation up to the Roman Empire, then turns to the succession of popes and German emperors who carried on the tradition of the Roman Empire. So it all ends up in Germany somehow. It starts with the first day of creation and then ends up somewhere in Germany. And Otto von Freising drew heavily on Augustine's notion on conception of world history. Similarly, Jans Ennickel's Weltchronik, World Chronicle from 1272, 84, we don't know exactly, begins with the creation of the world also and reviews historical events until the contemporary period, in this case, the death of Emperor Frederick II in 1250. But not every example of narrating world history began with the creation of the world. The Kaiserchronik, the Chronicle of Emperors, written around 1135, 55 in rhymed vernacular prose, so that's a shift here, foregrounded political genealogy. It begins with the history of the Roman Empire, so not with the creation of the world, but with the history of the Roman Empire, but then also extends to contemporary German times. Some scholars have argued that this text is quite independent from its biblical sources and other material that was convention at the time, and that the emphasis here is really on German and other rulers, while the sections on the religious leaders are short at best. So there were different types of world chronicles, some more secular and some more religious in a way. Another approach is evident in Rudolf von Emms's unfinished world chronicle from 1250-54, which was one of the most widely read books of the Middle Ages. In this chronicle, the author emphasized German claims, and this is why I'm talking about this here, the author emphasized German claims to sovereignty over Jerusalem. The work was commissioned by King Conrad IV, who had inherited the crown of Jerusalem through his mother, Isabel of Brienne, the daughter of King Johann of Jerusalem. So this is, you know, part of the title, König von Jerusalem, King of Jerusalem, goes back to actually Frederick II, who, when he married the daughter of who was then the king of the Crusader state of, you know, the king of Jerusalem, part of the Crusader states. And the first king was Baldwin II, 1118. So this title, King of Jerusalem, is connected to the creation of the Crusader states after the First Crusade. And then through dynastic connections, it became a title that this Stauffer dynasty claims, and Frederick II, and then later on, this was claimed by the Habsburg, and in fact, until today. So this, I finally found evidence for that. I mean, they sort of abdicated, but they still, you know, as a lot of the kings that are no longer kings still carry all the titles in their, you know, I don't know what the terminology exactly is or what the legal status of this is, but the title is still around in a way. So in this World Chronicle by Rudolf von Ems, which is commissioned by the king who claims, you know, King Conrad IV, who claims the title King of Jerusalem, Rudolf von Ems makes this genealogical connection central to his work, namely when he reviewed Jewish kings, so biblical Jewish kings, and praised Conrad as King of Jerusalem. The title King of Jerusalem is named first here in the chronicle among Conrad's royal titles, and this foregrounding of sovereignty over Jerusalem was a strategic move intended to establish the legitimacy of Conrad's rule. What becomes evident in this World Chronicle is also the struggle between Pope and Emperor. The invocation of Rome itself contains the double claim to sovereignty. Rome as the seat of the Pope and as the center of the world power during the Roman Empire, was sort of, I mean, the Stauffer dynasty during the holy, the reign of the holy, well, it was holy, it became holy at that point when Germans tried to claim that holiness as part of the title of the worldly rulers. So this is, in a way, this chronicle sort of articulates this appropriation of the religious dimension of the rule over Jerusalem. So it's not just a political claim, it is definitely a religious claim also, which is here expressed by the Stauffer dynasty, and this World Chronicle asserts this by emphasizing this title as the most important title among King Conrad's titles. So, in a way, I mean, I wouldn't go as far to say that these type of world chronicles are an attempt to secularize world history or present a really secular view of the world, but I think it's we can certainly say that's an appropriation of that dimension of the spiritual message into a concept of the worldly ruler who is then the representative of God on earth and in competition with the Pope. And this focus on reconciling different worldviews and the non-literary thrust of the genre might also explain why often religious enemies, such as Muslims, are not slandered in ways comparable to the conventions of religious propaganda literature. So this is interesting. In these world chronicles, you have fewer references to the enemy heathen in the Holy Land. It's really much more a battle between the church and the state. And who can assert what kind of powers and claims. But Jerusalem and the Holy Land figures centrally in this power struggle between worldly and secular rulers. So to sum this up a little bit, World Chronicles, along with other textual genres, articulated the German claim to sovereignty over the Holy Land, the twofold claim, religious and political. The twofold claim was affirmed through the connection to biblical history, the Roman Empire, and more generally to the European presence in the area during antiquity. German Holy Roman rulers laid claim to the area from which the biblical message had emerged. The different examples of world chronicles demonstrate that their authors used the available sources in eclectic ways and presented diverse interpretations of history depending on distinct ideological goals and political circumstances. I do not have the time to review the ways in which these German claims to the Holy Land stayed alive in the collective memory well into the modern period. World chronicles that began with the creation of the world and other medieval genres and traditions that expressed this German claim to the Holy Land were popular well into the 16th century. Another aspect that's important is that the wars against the Ottoman Empire from the late 14th to the 18th century were to a greater extent than I had expected, all still presented as religious wars. I was under the impression that sort of with Luther, you know, and with the Reformation and so forth, that you have actually an emphasis of this as a worldly endeavor, the political power structure. But if you look at the rhetoric, the same rhetoric is actually employed that was used during the Crusades. And in fact, there are a lot of stories and genres that stay on and or are sort of become more popular again during the confrontation with the Ottoman Empire. Politically, German rulers intervened in the Middle East once more beginning in the 19th century. Okay, not in the Middle East, meaning in this particular case in Palestine, because I mean they've been engaged through the confrontation with the Ottoman Empire the entire period, but in particular Palestine became a topic at the beginning of the 19th century. Germans actively participated in the European invasion of the area. In 1840, Austrians and Prussians supported a joint Ottoman-European military undertaking that ended the Egyptian occupation of Palestine. And this is kind of interesting because in a lot of our popular histories, whether it's Lapidus or Cleveland or whatever, the participation of the Ottomans and Prussians is not mentioned. It's all about the French and the British, but the actual participation of the Germans here is, for I don't know for what reason, but it's ignored. And this particular enterprise here, pushing the Egyptians out of Palestine, is really important for many, many reasons. And there was a fleet consisting of 17 British, 1 Turkish, and 3 Austrian ships. They seized Beirut, Sidon, and Acre was bombarded very heavily and then occupied by British and Austrian troops. In the aftermath, Germans as in Prussians, Austrians, and others, because we still don't have a German nation state, came to Palestine in increasing numbers as pilgrims, missionaries, and developers. They built roads, hospices, hospitals, and factories. And the most reliable postal service in Palestine in the second half of the 19th century was provided by the Austrians. King Frederick Wilhelm IV of Prussia quickly took action to assert a Christian Prussian presence in the area. In 1841, the Ottomans granted him permission to establish a Protestant diocese in Jerusalem. Christian activity in the area rose in the following years. In 1847, and for the first time since the Crusades, the Catholic Church appointed a patriarch to Jerusalem. Missionaries flooded into Palestine, supported by substantial financial support from Christian countries. Pilgrimages to the Holy Land became popular again. According to some estimates, between 10,000 and 20,000 pilgrims visited the Holy Land annually after the 1840s, including a high number of Western Europeans. Pilgrimages from German-speaking areas grew again into mass events, involving up to 500 pilgrims in specifically designed Volkswallfahrten, so people's pilgrimages. Of significant impact were also the activities of the Templar from Württemberg. A fundamentalist Christian sect, their importance in the history of Palestine was enormous in spite of their limited numbers. Based in Haifa, they developed trade, agriculture, and transportation. In 1905, a contemporary traveler described this German presence as follows. Haifa is practically a German town as far as its trade, agriculture, and property are concerned. Even the Russian, American, until lately the English consuls are Germans. The hotels, shops, and banks are German. The Roman Catholic Hospital and the hospice are in the hands of a German sisterhood. The sanatorium on Mount Carmel, with its luxurious accommodation and extensive grounds, rendezvous of English missionaries, is conducted by Germans. German and Prussian ambitions in the area were also affirmed through imperial visits. Emperor Franz Joseph, who claimed the title King of Jerusalem, a title that the Habsburg emperors, you know, still, as I mentioned earlier, holding till today, visited in 1869. Emperor Wilhelm II followed in 1898, landing in Haifa on, and this is a quote, on a specifically prepared landing stage run out from the German colony there. He was thus able to announce that he had landed on German soil. This renewed interest in Palestine immediately preceded and then coincided with the rise of anti-Semitism and the emergence of Zionism in German countries. So we're handing Zionism back to the Christians here, in a way. And this is another interesting chapter, the relationship between Herzl and the emperor, and why the emperor in the end didn't support him and so forth. So if you want to, we can talk about it in the discussion. But what I want to emphasize here is that the Germans played actually a very important role in opening up, if you wish, this whole area to what then became also the Jewish immigration. Yeah? But there were German colonies there and German developers and. So as we've seen, the Christian identity of German, in particular, also Habsburg rulers, was central in determining long-term German relations with the Middle East. With the decreasing relevance of Christianity in Germany since World War I, Germany's relationship to the Holy Land has changed fundamentally. But the ties that I have described here are relevant to contemporary political and cultural relations between the two spheres of influence, if you want to, you know, extend it to Europe or the West. And in particular, in those instances when political power is deeply inspired by Christian fundamentalism. And it's no coincidence that George Bush and Tony Blair are both born-again Christians. And, you know, the most recent events, I think, you know, demonstrate how much the Holy Land is still part of Europe's or the West's or the Christian West's sense of itself. I want to end here. And then